November 26th, 2019 session of TeamSpeak for Tangerine SDR. My name is Dave, KV0S, and this week I spent a lot of time working on getting my internet working again. I had a repairman here for about 2.5 hours. We replaced the modem, and he replaced several wires that he suspected of being broken. I think I got my problem fixed. I haven't noticed any problems since. So that's about it for me. Next on the list, we have Dave, KD0EAG. Go ahead, Dave.
Hello. Yes. I've been pretty busy last week. A lot of stuff relating to the magnetometer. Finished up the PCB for now and got boards ordered, and then got the rest of the BOM together and got it ordered. And have been working on code since, and pretty well have sorted out all the things that puzzled me at one time. Finally found what was going on. So everything's pretty good shape. Just plodding along. Over.
Fine business, Dave. And next on the list, we have Mike, AAAK, shown as recording and Mike muted, and we thank Mike for posting the recordings of TeamSpeak to tsarchive.tangerinesdr.com. Then, next on the list, we have Nathan, W2NAF. Go ahead, Nathan.
Hi, Dave. Thank you very much. Things are going just fine here in Scranton. I've been busy with a number of things. I've been working a bit on the Hamsai workshop logistics. We now have a keynote speaker. So Kim Duffy is going to be our keynote speaker for the Friday night banquet. We have our invited speakers lined up, and we're working on getting the information up on the website so that people can register soon. And submit abstracts. So hopefully that'll be up before the AGU meeting on December 9th. That's our goal. I've also been working on doing some farlap ray tracing, looking at one of the eclipse events, some of the eclipse Doppler shift events. So we've been doing that, and we're also starting to get ready for the AGU meeting. All right, back to the group, W2NAF.
Fine business, Nathan. And next on the list, we have Tom, N5EG. Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, good evening, Dave, and good evening to everyone in the group. Been pretty busy. Got the first package for the receiver done and shipped to Scotty and for review, and started on the AM broadcast band stop filter design, and hopefully have a little bit more practical design in terms of inductor values, and we'll get started on schematic capture for that. That's about it.
Sounds good. And next on the list, we have Troy, AC8XP. Go ahead, Troy.
Hi, everyone. Still having some push-to-talk issues, but I wanted to sit in for Frankie tonight. She's studying for a biology test, but I told her I would pinch hit. So I'll be listening and try to take some notes. And Dave, we did receive the package. Thank you very much. And already starting to document. So this is Troy. Back to the group.
Fine business, Troy, and you came through just fine on voice, so I just thought I'd let you know that. And next on the list, Scotty, WA2DFI. Go ahead, Scotty.
Okay, very good. Thanks, Dave, and thanks again for running the show here. We really appreciate it. It's good to hear everyone on. This past week has been kind of slow on the SDR front, but I did get Tom's schematic. Had a chance to look a little bit at it to make sure it jives with the connector pinout, and I'm not quite done with that, Tom. So I'll be working on that some more. probably would help if I could get the OrCAD version, because then I could look at the part numbers and all that and see, make sure everything is to spec and you didn't forget anything, which you probably didn't, but I want to check anyway. So, and I've been working a little bit on the DE schematic, and I've got a couple more pages done on that, and notably the RF module connectors. So it's kind of a good point to stop and make a double check and make sure we got everything in agreement, and we'll continue on with that. So I'm looking forward to getting something done over the holidays here this week, because while everyone else is going out of town or partying, we're going to be barricading ourselves in the house, and because it in Arizona here, it's supposed to rain on Thanksgiving and on Black Friday. So I don't even want to be out on the road on Black Friday in this town when it rains, because rain down here is like snow is back up where you are, Nathaniel. So it's everybody has to learn how to drive in and over again when the first rain comes. It occurs so infrequently. And on Black Friday with all the shoppers out, oh my goodness, I'll just barricade myself in the shack here and work on this. So that's the plan for this week. Go ahead, Dave, back over to you.
Fine business, Scotty. It sounds interesting, but good to hear that things are moving forward. So that brings us to the end of the list. So we're open for general discussion.
Scotty, this is Tom. Did you get the link to the folder with all the schematic and OrCAD and data sheets and all those files?
I didn't yet. Did you? You must have sent it late in the day. I left work early today. That's like 5:30. But it's not in your shared Dropbox folder. The only thing that's in there are some old revisions of schematics. So I don't know. Did you get a new address or a new link?
No, it should be the exact same folder. I trashed the older versions and put in a new zip file using that same link. I'm wondering if for some reason the link expires.
Well, it shows a folder that you and I share, but there's only, let's see, I'm looking at it right now. It's RxFM 5001D second draft zip and shared 19 days ago.
Oh, good heavens. Okay, I deleted that and I put the current version zip in its place, and I'm surprised. Did you try refreshing your browser cache?
Yep, I sure did. Let me do it again right here. No, unless there's some new sneaky way to clear this out, I'm not sure how I would do this, because it looks like it's called Tom Dropbox Shared Folder, and those are the only two files in it.
Okay. All right. It's in Dropbox / Receiver Schematics. Let me just go ahead and send you a link to that in a new email.
Okay. So did you get my email on the on the power to the filter connectors?
Yeah. The filters do not have any power. They're passive.
Well, yours are, but they won't all be that way.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll let you think about that. Mine are passive. I've got two grounds and two signals. The interface you can see from looking at the schematic.
Well, so on your board, the power pin will just be a no connect, but we still have to have one.
Okay. Then I'll have to make some changes to the receiver schematic.
Yeah, so hopefully, I was thinking about that, thinking that we're going to have a symmetrical connector so you can, because your desire was to be able to plug the boards in either way, wasn't that right?
Yeah, they were absolutely symmetrical component-wise, connector-wise, everything.
So obviously, boards that require power won't be pluggable in either direction, because they'll have active parts on them that drive a particular direction, most likely. But I think if we rotate the top connector and the bottom connector, pin number wise, the board will still be pluggable either way if we make the connectors the same.
Okay, I'm going to need to change the receiver schematic because I have ground on the two outside pins and signal on the two center pins.
Yeah, I noticed that. So is there a reason you doubled them up, or just because you had four pins?
Just because we had four pins, and by doubling them that way, it's completely symmetric.
Yeah, because I'm thinking you're probably going to want ground, signal, ground, plus. So you get a ground on either side of the signal, something like that.
Okay, well, I had ground, signal, signal, but two signals were tied together, ground, so it was the equivalent.
Yeah, I saw that, so okay. But like I said, at first I thought, oh, no, we're going to have to make it a five-pin connector so we can get two power pins. And I thought, well, no, if we just rotate the connectors, then you'll still be able to plug your board on either way.
Yeah. Okay. If I don't use the power, the question is, I can't ground it on the receiver. Well, maybe I can. I don't know. So, because if somebody tries to plug on some new kind of powered filter module and the receiver that I've designed puts a ground on it, it wouldn't work.
Right. You will have to take that pin off and make it an O-connect. So it'll just be physically the same connector, but it'll, and in fact, you can put 3 volts. In fact, you should put 3 volts on the pin. Because, and then on your filter board, you should make it a no connect. That way somebody's going to come along later and say, oh, I want to plug an active board onto your RF module. They'll have the power.
Okay. Well, then I just sent you the link to the schematic and you can ignore that. I'm going to have to redo the receiver schematic.
Okay. Well, you want to wait until we go through the whole thing and then you can, rather than make the changes piecemeal.
Oh, okay, sure. Anyway, you should have a link to the latest on its way.
Hey, by the way, everybody, I put Jason from Ham Radio 2.0 has added 3 more Detroit DCC videos this week, along with 7 other videos that had nothing to do with us. So I have linked those 3 in the appropriate places on the DCC talks page.
Thanks a lot, Dave. That's really good.
Yeah, the new ones are the threat to high voltage switching from solar EV, the 2-meter, 70-centimeter digital radio modulation basics, and AmperNet. Discussion.
Thanks for putting all those up, Dave.
I find it easier to have them in one spot than to have to search for them all through other things.
So were there only 4 talks on Friday?
No, all the talks are listed. Only the ones that have a link are the ones that he's put up a video on.
Oh, I see. That's right, because the lightning talks are in the middle. Sorry.
Yep.
Do you happen to know whether he's going to put up the Sunday seminar or not?
I don't know. I haven't really talked to him at all.
I emailed him, and at least for, I asked him about my Sunday seminar from 2018, and he said there was a problem with the audio, so that video is not postable.
What about the latest one on SatMogs?
I think he has intentions of putting that up.
I know he recorded it, but he could have had a problem with the audio on that one too, because I'm not sure that George actually, well, George was there with the audio, so it should have been the same as the other days.
Yeah, I don't know the details for that one.
Scotty, I had a question about who, this is a question not about our website, but about the Tapper website. Who maintains the list of the DCCs on the Tapper website? It turns out 2018 is the same list as 2017, and I didn't give a talk in 2018, but I did in 2017, and I'm listed on both years.
Okay, so he's got a copy. Well, usually it's John Coster, W9DDD, and he's usually, what he does is he copies it, and then he substitutes the new talks for the old ones. So it may be either in the middle of him doing that, or maybe he's... you know, he's retiring at the end of the year from his duties as office manager, and I think he's going to retire from the web page maintenance too, because we're moving the web page to a different. It's going to become a WordPress web page instead of whatever it is that they use to maintain it now, and so I think that things are going to change come up here quick. But that would be a good comment. I didn't notice that he did that.
Well, it's one, the 2019 is correct and the 2017 is correct, but the 2018 in the middle is basically a copy of 2017. I'll send John a comment.
Okay, I'm looking at it now. This, you're talking about the sidebar along the side here where you can click on any year you want?
Yeah, and then you go to 2018 and list the talks, and they're all the 2017 talks.
Oh, why, yes, they certainly are, aren't they? So Dave gave a talk twice too.
That's right. You've got multiple talks, many more talks than the three of us gave, although you probably gave more talks than that.
Yeah, I think I talk at every one of these, much to people's dismay.
Oh, Scotty, you're so interesting.
Well, if they don't nod off asleep or stone me, I guess I'm okay.
No, I'm just teasing you.
Let's see, so Albuquerque, I guess my talk was on Saturday at Albuquerque. Oh, no, that was the talk on the single board computers. Yeah, so it's definitely missing.
Yeah, and I was looking for just a listing. It turns out you can't, I haven't figured out how to get to a PDF of the program so that I could get the listing. But anyway, I know I have found Phil Karn's talk, and or at least his slides and his paper. So there are some pieces floating around different places.
Well, I still have a thumb drive with all the talks, all the presentations on it. So, but actually, I take that back. I think I gave the thumb drive to John. So, because I figured the cheapest and easiest thing to do is at the end of the conference, just hand him the drive, and then we don't have to worry about how to download or email or anything like that. And he can just copy them to the web page directly.
Yep. So hopefully he still has it. He probably has it in a box somewhere.
Well, if he doesn't, I have copies on the computer because I still have the same computer that we used, and they were all the ones that they use my computer for, I have. The other ones that use their own computer, I probably don't have those on the computer. They'd be only on the thumb drive. So, Nathaniel, do we have a hotel for the conference yet?
Yes, we do. It is going to be the Scranton Hilton, the Hilton in downtown Scranton. I think they're still working on setting up the room block, but that will be the hotel.
Okay, so how far is that from the venue?
It's about a block. A block or two.
Okay, so it's like shorter than the Case Western hike.
Oh, yeah, it's going to be very convenient. So there's actually a hotel that's even closer that you could stay at. So the reason I picked the Hilton for the hotel block, though, is I think it's a little bit more modern and a little bit cleaner and a little bit more comfortable. The other hotel, though, is really cool because it's the that's the Radisson. That's the old Lackawanna train terminal. So if you'd rather be in a more historic building that's actually closer to the talks, you can get a room there.
Oh, no, that would be cool. Don't tell Steve Bible or he'll reserve all the rooms for himself.
All right. Well, so I will let you guys know about that. So even though we'll have a main room block over at the Hilton, if you want, they're right across the street from each other. So it's really kind of inconsequential. But yeah, if you're a train buff, you probably do want to stay in the Radisson. And there's a little pathway that goes straight from that hotel right over to the meeting building.
Oh, that sounds awesome. And you know, I'm a pretty cheap date. I'd go to the cheapest room because I figure I don't really spend much time in the room with these things.
Oh yeah, that's true. Here, I will send you the link. I'll put the link up there to that.
So I would think Dan would also be interested in that.
Yeah, I think he would. And there were a couple people. Was it Rob, I think, maybe was a train buff too.
So the other thing I'm trying to have happen is I'm trying to get a National Parks on the Air type operating event at the Steamtown Museum National Historic Site on Sunday morning. So if people are still there on Sunday, they can go see the steam trains and have an operating HF station there.
Oh, so we should make sure to leave late Sunday then.
Yes, that's right. And get there early Thursday because I want to meet, I want to have like drinks in the bar over at this Radisson Hotel in the old train station hotel. There, I just sent a link out to the Radisson.
Okay, but you won't have any special rates for the Radisson, but you'll have a special rate for the Hilton, right?
You know, we might be able to do both. I can talk to the administration because they do have the Radisson also has a University of Scranton agreed rate, so we might be able to do both.
Yeah, that would be very good. And do you normally reserve a block of rooms like we do for DCC or no?
Yes, we do. So even the Radisson, it looks like they start at $110 a night. So, I mean, that's still a pretty good rate.
Yeah, that is. So, and if you have a military ID or a student ID or an AARP card or something like that, you probably get at least $10 off.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's see. I'm checking the rates for so it's going to be the 19th through the 22nd. Check availability. Okay, so it's looking like the prepaid rates there. It's a little more expensive. It's looking like it's around $150 for a 2-queen bed for that weekend. But yeah, I can look into. I'll ask if we can get the university rates for that hotel as well.
Okay, sounds good. Yeah, because I know we have a hotel down in Bisbee, which is an old copper mining town in southeast Arizona, and they pretty much restored it to the way it was. I think their only concession to modernity is telephones, but there's no televisions, there's no radios, it's kind of like what it was back in the old days, in the old mining days, except where they do concede to put phones in. And the dining room is all outfitted in the old style. It's really an impressive hotel.
Yeah, that sounds really cool. That sounds really nice. Yeah, this the train station, the Radisson one, it's the inside, it's all very much like the train station was. It's really quite beautiful. So, and here's the link to the Hilton. And I'll get a walking map from the Hilton over to the Loyola Science Center. All right, hold on.
Okay, I just tried 20 February to 23 February. And if you're willing to prepay, it's $108 per night at the Radisson.
Okay, don't forget, it's March 20th, 21st, 20 and 21st. It's March, not February.
Okay, that would probably make a big difference.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to prepay for a February booking.
Still shows 108. That's for a single. Oh, no, you're right. It does say prepaid 155. Oh, darn. So on the top page, it says book this hotel from 108 per night, even with given those dates. Yet when you click on check availability, it's 150. That's interesting. There isn't anything else going on that weekend, is there?
Not that I'm aware of. It's a spring break even, so it should be pretty quiet, I think. Okay, that last link I sent is the walking map from the Radisson train station hotel over to our building.
Didn't you say there was a passageway between the two buildings?
Yeah, it looks like it's using that. It goes right over Route 11 and 307. That's actually a little passageway that runs right along next to the train tracks. Probably if you put the satellite view on, you should see that. So there's like a little pedestrian bridge right across Route 11 and Route 307.
Okay, but the buildings don't connect together. You have to go outside, right?
Yeah, you do have to go outside. But it's only 0.2 miles.
Yeah, I think we can handle that. I mean, the weather was a lot cooler at Case than it'll be in March.
Yeah, it's a very easy walk. And, so the building we'll be in is the one that says the Loyola Science Center. And if you look in the other direction, you can see where the Steamtown National Historic Site is. So those train tracks go right over to there.
Even that looks like it's walkable.
Oh yeah, it absolutely is. Everything is very walkable here.
Looks like a nice roundhouse.
Oh yeah, it's absolutely beautiful. Part of it is the original roundhouse, and then part of it is some new roundhouse that they built for the museum. It's also interesting because you can see that marketplace at Steamtown. There's a mall over there. So the mall actually connects over to the historic site. So you go into the mall, and then there's a footpath that takes you, it's like a boardwalk that takes you from the mall, and you walk over into the historic site. And it gives you a nice, almost aerial view of all of the trains. So you're walking in over the train tracks and over the old train cars as you walk into the museum area.
Oh, Well, okay. Look great. I'm going to have to get my airline ticket soon here.
Yeah, hopefully you can get a flight right into that Scranton airport, because that's super convenient.
You know if Southwest flies in there?
I don't know. It's airport code AVP.
Nope, they did not.
So the best way to fly in is through, what did you say?
AVP, the Scranton-Wilkes-Barre Airport.
Okay.
There's a link to it.
There's a shuttle from there, right?
It's only about 15 minutes away.
And I think the hotel has a shuttle, doesn't it?
I don't know, but it would make a lot of sense.
Or an Uber.
Yeah, there's a ground transportation link on the AVP website too. I guess you really don't need a rental car for this trip. If you can just Uber over or get the shuttle, that would definitely be a good way to go.
Scotty, it looks like your airline choices are Delta, American, and United.
Oh, okay. Thanks. Delta, American, United. I'm going to write that down.
I looked at arrivals, and those are the airline codes that are listed there. Connections to Philadelphia, Washington, Chicago, Detroit, Charlotte. So probably, if coming from the west, Chicago would be the best place to go.
If I get too irritated, I'll just drive out.
You're one of the few people that I know that likes to drive all the way across the country regularly.
Yes, so see, my judging is how far is it from St. Louis? Because it's my eastern home base at my brother's place.
Ah, I see.
But Scranton's a long way from St. Louis.
Yeah, it's the trip you just made plus some.
But you know, my parents used to live in Williamsburg, which is, just, unless you go up into New England, it's about as far away from St. Louis as you can get along the East Coast. And that's an easy day's drive for me. It's only 800 miles.
The Pennsylvania turnpike's a real joy, especially that time of year, probably.
Oh, yeah, I imagine so. But I used to live back east, so it'll bring back memories of the old days.
The old days.
So, Dave, when do you get your magnetometer boards back?
Well, it looks like some of the very first one, you know, the first ones that are screwed up, I'll get back tomorrow or the next day, maybe. But the others are going to be probably Monday or Tuesday next week.
Okay, and then, of course, you have to assemble them, right? Do you have all the parts in hand?
I don't have them all. Well, I probably do have them all in hand, but I reordered to make it more consistent and I expect I'll have those in a day or two, a couple days, usually from DigiKey. Got everything from DigiKey, though there does seem to be one piece, nothing that matters. I've got, something seems to be back ordered or something, but, everything, let's see, I was going to tell you how much it was costing. I think it was coming down to about under $12, something around $12 per board for parts, and I did not shop for the cheap ones. I just kind of went probably over-spec'd them. And the boards themselves are about $10 a piece at the quantity, you know, at these prototype quantities. And then the magnetometer board is about $20. So all together, you've got $40 is the raw cost of these things.
That sounds pretty good there.
Yeah, that does sound good.
So Dave, what we would have one local extender module, one remote extender module, and then a magnetometer module to make the total solution?
That is correct.
Okay, so that would be $40 or $60?
Let's see, that would probably make it be $60, maybe $70.
Okay, That's a pretty good solution.
I did not make any effort whatsoever to economize on anything at this stage, so it conceivably could be squeezed down a little bit.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of people are anxious to get first units, so I think that's a good decision.
Yeah, it's never a good idea to try to cost reduce and design at the same time. You just end up in trouble.
Yeah, I think it's kind of like Phil Erickson's philosophy on software development. It is optimized last, they said.
That's right, get it working first.
That's right, we want it working.
I understand that philosophy well. And I think there's no guarantee that this is, you know, that I'm not going to have to run another set of boards, but pretty much the parts are the same. Actually, I think DigiKey, when I uploaded the BOM, it kept telling me, oh, you're buying 20 of these. You could buy, you know, some other number and get a price break. And I just said yes to everything. So that might've bumped the cost up a little unrealistically in a way that'll knock it down later.
Well, prototypes always cost more, and that's just the way it is.
I started to do some work trying to create footprints or, you know, the part component, whatever you call it, footprints in KiCad for the individual, the magnetometry sensor components. That's new, very new territory for me, and I have no idea what I'm doing. So, I thought it would be nice to experiment with it so that at some point, if we can identify a manufacturer, we could actually have the parts mounted on the board and not pay to mount a second board on top of it.
So are you talking about the magnetics or the ICs?
It's three magnetic components and one IC. It's some sort of little ASIC, probably an ASIC DSP or something they're using, plus the three different
user was moved to your
components are, you know, that they're basically a simple little coil, partly double wound, that they use to discriminate the directions.
Yeah, because I think I'd like, if it's cost effective, to try and mount everything on the board, but we'll have to see if that will ever work out. But like you said, first things first, get it working, then worry about trying to build hundreds of them for cheap.
I just totally wasn't going to worry about that part of it for right now, except just to see if I could design those footprints. But I really think getting something that works with the little, they call them breakout boards. They are 1-inch square, so that makes a minimum size of this thing. But the risks involved in trying to manufacture that part of the board right now seemed a little too much, too scary to me.
I think Hyomin Kim just joined. I think he's a TeamSpeak user. I think he can hear us, but I'm not sure if he can talk.
Yeah, Hyomin, if you can hear us, go over to the Tangerine tab at the bottom, Tangerine SDR tab, and you can type a message to us and we can see if you can hear us.
Yeah, he sent me a text saying that he could hear us. He says he hears people talking, but he says he's still not used to this software.
Figured out the chat. User.
Dave, you want to give him the directions?
Well, he did put "I hear you" at the bottom, so he's able to chat.
Do you want us to help you, Hyomin? Okay, I think he wants some help.
Well, for to set up the microphone, you need to go to Tools. Then at the bottom of that menu item, there's Options. And then once you get Tools, Options, the fourth item down is Capture. and then you can set up your mic for push to talk. And there's a way that you can set the hotkey for your push to talk, and you just click the button, and there's a push to talk button, and then you can click any button you want to go there. Then it's a good idea to do some testing to make sure your settings are right. And then it should, when you come back, you can just hold down the push to talk button when you want to talk.
Also, you may want to test your input volume. I think at least on my version, it has a little doodad to test whether it's responding to your voice.
Oh, we saw your PTT light there for a second. Okay, well, break in any time you get it working. We'll look forward to talking to you, because I think we have questions, or at least an update for you. And Nathaniel, I just went on United, and this is something that people might want to keep in mind. I punched the dates in. Turns out if I leave on Monday after the conference, the flight is $200 cheaper than if I left on Sunday.
Wow, that's really good.
So it's like $521 round trip from Phoenix if I come in on Thursday and leave on Sunday. It's $321 round trip if I come in on Thursday and leave on Monday.
So you basically get a free night in a hotel.
Yeah, $321 round trip. That's incredibly cheap for all the way to the East Coast. The only problem is that I don't get in until 6:22 p.m. There's an earlier flight, but it's about $70 more.
Well, if you get to stay on Sunday, I mean, then you have the nice opportunity to go look at the Steamtown Museum or some of the other museums, or we can just chat more or any of those things.
Oh, yeah, so we can hang out for a while if you got time on Sunday.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Oh, can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, sorry. I forgot how to use this push to talk kind of function. So I just found out that it's the hotkey is actually shift, left shift. So I'm here. Sorry.
Sounds good.
Welcome, human.
Thank you.
So Dave, you want to give him a super quick update of the stuff we talked about on the, like when you're getting the board and all that?
I assume you mean me. I'm expecting to get the bare boards for the magnetometer hopefully, you know, early next week, Monday or Tuesday. I've also got all the parts probably coming in. Hopefully they'll get here either Wednesday or Friday, I suppose, or maybe Saturday. Now how quickly I can assemble one is another question. Overall, I kind of have a sense that the raw parts cost on these prototypes is hovering around, let's see, $10 for the bare board, another 10 or 12 for the soldered on components, and then another $20 for the breakout board from PNI of the magnetometer. And you'll need two of these boards for a remote connection, but you'll only need one magnetometer breakout. So that means it's gonna be around $70. This is raw cost to assemble everything you need, hopefully, plus a cable.
So I can go to the Tapper board and ask for, you know, $750 to build 10 of these.
Well, there's no absolute need to do that at the moment. But it's a nice idea, and 750. I have about five of the magnetometer breakouts plus the one I use myself. And I don't know how much, I haven't got that much in it, but that would be, yeah, you're right. That's more than I have on hand. So the money's not a big obstacle at the moment. Some point it might be nice to be reimbursed, but I'm not real concerned at the prototype stage.
Okay, well, so when the dust settles here, you're going to have enough to, you said you got five boards, so you're going to have enough to make two working local and remote pairs, right?
I'm going to get, I should have, with luck, I will have six working PCB boards with, and I have the parts, I guess I have the parts to populate those into pairs. I ordered six because they come in triplets. And you got to buy three at a time of the boards. But if I had bought another, if I find out they work, and I, the minute I know that they work, then I'll order some more. And hopefully before Christmas, we could have a good bunch of them working.
Okay, well, keep your receipts, and I'm sure Tapper will reimburse you for those, or maybe Nathaniel will, somebody will, so you won't have to pay out-of-pocket expenses. And then, Nathaniel, you and I got to sit down and figure out how many we can use, or maybe Heelman can help us to, some number of additional ones to build. So let's let you do your thing, Dave, and make sure it works before we get too ahead of ourselves.
Well, I want to make sure it works, and I want to make sure it addresses Heelman's concerns, and make sure it fits the bill, particularly for his criteria.
So maybe you guys have already talked about this, are we getting some kind of number from the sensor right now?
Yes. At this point, I believe I'm getting raw and computed nanotesla raw values, and then I finally sorted out what they were talking about getting actual nanotesla out of it for each access.
Was it tricky? I'm just curious because my students, although they're not really familiar with the system or hardware in general, but they seem to struggle a lot with getting like right numbers.
I won't guarantee that my numbers are right numbers, but I did find it confusing. I stumbled over a bunch of things and made it take a frustratingly long amount of time. In the end, it's simple, but it always is in the end. So I found something I needed to know in an FAQ, and it's as far as coding it's not that hard, but you have to understand that it's probably a little different than some other I2C stuff that most people are used to.
Okay, well, sounds good. Since my students have never seen magnetometer working before, so they thought that they have gotten right numbers. But what I found is that when you actually like even, you know, even though you don't have any good measure of, sensitivity or resolution level of magnetometer, what you can do is to change the orientation. Like even if you change the position of the sensor a little bit, you have to see some number changing, which my student didn't find. Like it was just obviously very non-sensitive, some level. So one thing you can do easily is that when you change the position or orientation like slightly, you have to see some number changing dramatically.
I think I'm well past that stage at this point. I've had numbers that changed nicely for a long time. I just didn't have a clue what they meant because there were some constants that I didn't understand. Turns out it was the gain, which is set by the cycle counts. And I'll try to write it up sensibly so other people can understand. The other thing I did was I bought one of their complete little test boards, and they gave me, the company P&I gave me some software that they said worked, and it took a little, it had a bug or two, but it did work, and I kind of have some numbers to compare with that. Currently I have sent that to Frankie and Troy to play with. That uses some Windows software, and I'm mostly doing Linux things, but that gave me more confidence in what I was doing.
Sounds great. Yeah, I mean, if you need some help, like, I mean, I don't really know much about hardware itself, but if you need some help with, like, how to verify that what you're seeing right now is something useful, meaningful, then I can maybe talk more about that in detail later.
I appreciate that. I'm kind of hoping to get a little web page that presents data as it's being collected that people could see remotely. But I was playing with that this afternoon again. Once I get that cleaned up, maybe I can open up a port that somebody can connect to it remotely and see what it looks like it's doing.
Great, thank you very much.
Do you have any actual numbers that you can relate to us of what your students are seeing with the same chipset here?
So roughly speaking, depending on where you are, you can use your own geographic location, say, I don't know, like, say, Newark, New Jersey, then I can take a look at what value I can expect to see from there. The easiest way, you know, like, very quick and dirty way to verify that the number you're seeing is actually something useful is that you take each individual values from X, Y, Z component and calculate the absolute value by using square root and, you know, X squared plus Y squared plus Z squared, and then take the square root of it, then you can expect to see absolute value of that. That number can be given depending on where you are. And then you can take a look at that value, some expected value from website. I can give that value to you if you want. Then if the number sort of close to that, that number you actually calculated, then you're getting there. But I don't know much about the hardware itself, I don't know what type of number you're getting right now. I think that's the most challenging part, you know. Is it just bit number or some type of voltage level that they produce from the sensor? That's something that I really want to know.
The sensor appear to produce an uncorrected value, or at least a raw value that's a fairly large number, can be a fairly large number. But it's, you divide it in on each axis by the gain, and the gain is settable on each individual axis. What I didn't realize for quite a while was that the code I had found was dividing each of these raw values. It was dividing everything by 75, and I could find nowhere why it was dividing by 75. Finally, I stumbled across the fact that 75 corresponds to the gain on each axis when the cycle counts are set to 200, which is the default. Now, that paper by the people up at University of Michigan, they were measuring it with using a cycle count set to about 800. And so all their, whatever they were measuring was done that way. But I'm quite confident most of the adjusted nanotesla values seem to be in, you know, mostly, numbers under 1,000 after you've corrected for gain, but haven't experimented with it all that much.
So depending on where you are, but basically, for example, like New York, New Jersey, the total value should be close to, say, 40,000-ish nanotesla, which is 40 microtesla or 0.4 gauss. So I don't know if you're getting that kind of number. What you can do is that you actually hold a sensor and then rotate it in any direction, random direction, to see what range of numbers you're seeing. I don't know if that produces signed or unsigned number.
Yeah, and that's something I just have to check that I'm consistent in my code. Early on, I was getting signed numbers. I increased the sizes of the variables I was copying into. I may have done some casts that threw out the signs, but it does seem to be quite very sensitive to in each individual access to any manipulation. And each access independently of the others. In fact, I believe I decided I could see just bringing my hand close to the sensor, made minor alterations to it.
Yeah, that seems natural. That seems normal to me. You know, it should be really sensitive to any kind of change of position or orientation. That seems very promising to me.
One question I've had looking at the other project that Nathaniel gave us documents for last week, they seem to have been correcting with those sensors for temperature, and I didn't know if temperature was an issue. I haven't seen any mention of it with regard to these sensors.
Yeah, I don't know most of the stuff that you're talking about seems to be very much this particular sensor specific. So I don't really know how to address these issues. But in general, magnetic sensors, most of the magnetic sensors are sensitive to the temperature, and especially like flux gate magnetometers, you have to have temperature compensation in your algorithm or sensor electronics. So what you do is to change the ambient temperature to see how they respond, and then you have to have some kind of compensation circuitry. I don't know if this sensor is has some kind of built-in temperature compensation or not. So that's something, you know, because this is sort of a new type of sensor for everybody. So, this is something that we really have to address and explore.
That seems like the kind of thing we need to be watchful of, so we don't make the system so that's difficult to do when we need it.
That's right.
So Hammond, you don't have anyone using this sensor in any experiments today, right?
Well, as far as I know, the Michigan group, I believe Dave has been talking to the people in Michigan, or just you look at the papers and stuff. But I know the person who was involved in development of this type of sensor, I think they are the only one who actually used this sensor for actual long-term observations. But I don't know how successful the mission was. Otherwise, this is very new type of sensor that very few people have used before. So that's why I cannot really give any insight or experience with this type of sensor.
Okay, because I was hoping maybe we could get the kind of a verification that our numbers are in the ballpark anyway. But looks like we're going to be pioneering as the first ones.
Hillman, you have said something about having other types of sensors there at Jenny Jump or someplace. Didn't you say that maybe we can compare to?
That is correct. We have a fluxgate magnetometer at Jenny Jump, so we can compare. That's actually really good quality science grade magnetometer. So we can, I believe that's well calibrated. So we can compare that magnetometer that we are developing by putting those side by side. So definitely we can do that.
Well, that makes for a lot of little interesting things to learn about this. Also, the Michigan people kept talking about some modifications to this these sensors. I don't know whether they are before or after the units we're working with, but it sounded like they had an in with the manufacturer. And I don't know whether they proposed some changes that improve the behavior. They didn't really. If it's in that document, and that's all I have, if what they were doing differently is in there, I don't know. I may have missed it. I've read it through a couple times, but it'd be nice to know.
So I don't know if I actually mentioned this to you before. The impression that I got first time I saw this type of product, the impression that I got was that, oh, this is a sensor that was manufactured by a company. So I thought this would be just completely plug and play kind of stuff. But seems like it's not the case, because I think the Michigan group, especially the Professor Mark Moldwin, I don't know what type of involvement he made, but I think he sort of worked together with the company to develop this type of new sensor, which hasn't been around since very recently. So we don't, looks like, you know, things are not really fully developed in the sense that, you know, something that you're doing, something like what you're doing right now, like, you know, the number that you're getting, you have to divide some by some number and stuff. I think that all the technical details have to be still figured out. The reason why we chose this magnetometer is because fluxgate is really widely used type magnetometer for space research, but the problem is the price. Then there's a much cheaper version of magnetometer, but the performance level is not even close to what we want. So we've been looking for something between fluxgate and this really, really cheap magnetometer. And it seems like this is a very, very good candidate because it is very inexpensive. But when I look at the performance level, it was really, really comparable to what we want. But it seems like since this is newly developed, I think a lot of engineering details have not been really fully established.
It doesn't seem to me that it's well enough developed that we'll get what we want out of it. There's just a good bit to be documented. I suspect that their customers in the past, at least until recently, they've worked pretty closely with whoever they worked with. I found something in the congressional record where the Navy, back quite a ways back, at least like in the late 90s or somewhere, recommended that something that sounded like this be issued a patent without describing exactly what it was. It looked like one of those things the military does. So it's probably been around for 20 years, but not for people like us until recently. I see some of the drone people are picking it up too. I don't know quite why they want something like this, but it's not that it's hard to use. It's just that we have to figure a bunch of stuff out of it. We're just kind of the first ones there.
So does that mean that the documents are not fully made?
Well, so far the documentation does seem to all be there. It's just, maybe it's just me. I once in a while I read through stuff and I miss important points. But after interacting with one of their people, and I did by email, ask questions and stuff, which she responded very nicely to. I kind of got a hold on it. She did say something about the next revision of the documentation when it comes out, having a few things changed.
All right, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Hillman and Dave. And I think we're a little over our hour here, so anybody have anything else? All right. Well, anyway, everyone have a great Thanksgiving, and we'll see you all next Monday.